Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. This month, Elmore Leonard Remembered. The program will open with my interview with Elmore and his son Peter that was first aired in June of 2009. Then, Mary Elizabeth Pope and her sizzling collection of short stories, Divining Venus. At the end, Fleeta Brown and the engaging poetry of Maurice Manning. I'm sitting with Elmore Leonard and Peter Leonard in Elmore's house, somewhere in suburban Detroit. So Elmore Leonard, author of 43 published novels. Some people say you are the greatest crime writer in the history of the genre.
I think it was Time magazine, and that gets in the way. There are reviewers who disagree. We'll name several who they think are better or as good, including Chesterton and Father Brown.
I remember reading an article in USA Today a few years ago, an editor taking you to task on that very fact, and Pete Dexter came to your rescue.
Oh, yes, he did.
Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
And the other voice we hear is Peter Leonard, and Peter now has his second book out.
Right, Trust Me.
Trust Me, which is a real page-turner. I enjoyed that immensely also. So we have two new books, Trust Me and Road Dogs. Road Dogs. The interesting thing in this one is you bring back three characters. We have Jack Foley from Out of Sight, Dawn Navarro from Riding the Rap, and Kundo Ray from La Brava. And I should say, Kundo, some of us thought he was a goner, but you managed to resuscitate him.
Yeah, I was afraid he was dead. No one said he was. So I got the place in La Brava, and he was shot three times by Joe La Brava. But then I have a couple of emergency fellas come in and say, hey, this one's still alive. His heart's still beating, and they rush him off to the hospital, and he's in a coma for 30 days or so.
And he reappears.
Yes, I needed him.
Going back to that story, did the characters come first and then the plot, or was the plot in front of you, and then you plugged in the available characters?
Well, the characters come first. I decided to use those three, and beginning with Jack Foley, because he was in a previous book that George Clooney starred in the movie, Out of Sight. And I had reason to believe he liked it a lot, and the picture was popular, and he would like to do it again. But I was wrong. He said he didn't want to play another. That is, so far, he says he doesn't want to play another bank robber. But he was given the manuscript maybe 6 or 8 months ago, and we're hoping he's changed his mind since I gave him the book. I sent him the book with an inscription to George. Said, George, Jack Foley's looking for you. We'll see if that does anything.
And there was one character in the book that I thought would stay with the rest of the story, and that's Megan, the lawyer. She is such a strong character, but there was no need for her to continue, but I just had this feeling that she was going to pop up again.
I did, too.
Oh, okay.
When I introduced her, and there was that possibility, because she is a strong character, and she's an individual, and she has a way about her that would work very well in the book, perhaps representing him again if anything came up. And I thought maybe Karen Sisko, who was his girlfriend in another one, I thought she would come along. Then once we meet Dawn Navarro, I said, that's enough. We have enough. Dawn can handle the female role fine.
The interesting thing about, was Karen Sisko?
Mm-hmm.
The marshal. In the book that she was in, you have this long chapter where she is in a trunk with Jack Foley. I don't know of any other place in literature where you have an extended scene in a trunk.
It's about 6 minutes, too, in the film. And everyone who read it in Hollywood loved that scene, and they weren't sure how to light it. I said, your flashlight, that's all.
Yeah.
And it'll work.
It's a great scene. Do your characters always come first? I mean, you know that a lot of writers carefully plot every minute.
No, I don't know what's going to happen. So I always start with the characters and put them in a situation. And then they sort of introduce the story. They fall into something, into some kind of a situation, and then we're off.
Peter, how do you approach it? Are you sort of character driven, or did you start with a plot? And
I started with a plot. Trust me, I think the inspiration came from an article in the Detroit Free Press. Crooks dressed as cops rob a bookmaker in suburban Detroit. So you know that was kind of an interesting premise for a story. I developed a plot around that and the characters to go with it. I'm more concerned about plot than my father is. I think I have to be.
So do you do an outline or?
No. I just write as I go along. I make up the story. Unlike Elmore, it's more fun that way. If I don't know what's going to happen, then the reader isn't going to know what's going to happen.
So there's a surprise when you go back to work.
Exactly. Although I kind of knew where I was going. I didn't know how the story would end, but I knew. Kind of what was going to happen.
The characters in both of your books are interesting, original. They have a series of flaws. Is that a right to say?
Absolutely.
Relatively flawed characters. So I'm wondering, where do the characters come from there? Are these people you've met? Are they composites? Or are they just absolute imagination?
I think they're just made up. Probably there are little parts of people I know, but I can't say that anyone is has come out of a real person, a friend, or anyone that I know. It's each one has something about him or her that is unique and interesting. Try and make them as human as possible.
And if I can go back to your rules on writing, your 10 rules of writing, which were in the New York Times and 2001, you advise writers to avoid detailed descriptions, and you sort of cite Hemingway.
Yeah, I say avoid detailed descriptions unless you're good at it. And there are writers, of course, who are very good at it, and in the description of the character, the character becomes more interesting. But to stop the story when the door opens and someone comes in, and then describe the person physically, I think is a big mistake.
Yeah, it really cuts the narrative flow, doesn't it?
You don't need to know all that. You don't need to know that the eyes are far apart or the narrow chin. No, that means nothing because the reader is going to picture someone. If the reader pictures anyone at all, it's going to picture something, a character that appeals to him or he doesn't like or whatever it is. But he's going to picture somebody.
You can tell a lot about a person just by the way they talk and what they say.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a little, description of a guy touching his mustache or a woman putting her hair behind her ears so you know that her hair is mm-hmm. long enough. Just little things like that that you sprinkle throughout.
So it's the nuance rather than the major description. How about your characters? Are they... I mean, I was worried about what to wear today after reading Trust Me because, one of my favorite things is a worn University of Michigan T-shirt. Well, that fits with one of your characters. I didn't want to look like I had come out of the book.
If you've ever been to a U of M game, you see how fanatical they are. And, half the stadium is that's where that came from. But I think most of my characters are composites. They're, I just pick up little pieces of people that I have... known and met and maybe even read about. But Eau Claire in Trust Me is actually based on a guy I went to high school with. The real Eau Claire is a big guy, and he was a tough guy, and so I modeled my character after him. I mean, my character is not exactly like him, doesn't necessarily talk like him, but maybe shares an attitude with him.
Okay. I have to put in a quick message here that I'm sitting with Elmore Leonard and Peter Leonard, and we're talking about crime fiction. Our listeners are always interested in how writers work. Most writers today work with word processors. Mm-hmm. I don't think you do.
No, I use yellow pads, unlined, and I write it all. Everything, every word is written longhand first. And then it's put on this typewriter, whatever it is, an IBM typewriter.
We're sitting at Elmer Leonard's desk. We're actually looking at the text. I see you use a little marker. What are those?
What's that?
This little pencil.
Well, that's a pen, yeah.
Precise, yeah, and a beautiful little handwriting. And then the first typed copies. About how many words do you do a day?
Well, say 4 or 5 pages of longhand, which comes to maybe 3 pages of
typed.
Typed.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So that's 700 words.
I get slower. I become slower as I get older, and start a little bit later. I used to start very early and work right through the day. And now it's I'll get going about 11, 11:30, and then work until 6. But I always work until at least 6.
Mm-hmm. And how long does a book take?
Now it takes about 9 to 10 months. It used to take 4 or 5 months when I was at my peak.
Interestingly, Aaron, when I was a little kid, I would go down the basement at our house in Lathrop Village, and I would see my father working, and there would be these yellow sheets of paper balled up next to a wastebasket across the room, scenes that didn't make it. But, you know, he's doing it the same way he was doing it then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same. This desk has the same look of the desk
the other one.
40 years ago,
yeah.
50 years ago.
So how do you work?
I write on lined yellow legal pads. I've always written with a pen first,
mm-hmm.
and I do it that way. I'll write a chapter, and I fill up every inch of paper with notes and observations, and then I transcribe it to a Apple computer,
mm-hmm.
an iMac, and I have a laptop, too, that I use. On weekends, I just sit in a chair with my feet up on an ottoman and write on the legal pad. It's
wow.
Very relaxing.
So how long does... I mean, you've been working full-time, so you've been working at night or weekends? Or
yes, whenever I fit it in. I've done 3 books that way, and it's pretty grueling. And it takes about, a year, a little over a year, part-time to write a book.
Wow. It's still a real productive kind of approach.
Yeah, I do something every day.
One of the things I noticed about your book, Peter, which is interesting, now, and I want to come back to this, hopefully, Elmer, your books are always books of place. You know, we're in Detroit or we're in southern Florida or something. And, Peter, you've done the same thing. You're mostly around Detroit, but you've done one other thing which I haven't seen done quite to this level. Cars become so important in your book, and people are what they drive.
Well, we live in the Motor City.
And one of the things that interested me was Eau Claire is sort of down at the heels, and he's driving a sagging Cadillac.
An old STS. Yeah,
an old
with
STS.
Cracked leather seats and a cracked windshield. And, I mean, that's the kind of car that, I would imagine a guy like Eau Claire, an ex-cop, ex-con, heavy, who's a collector for a bookie, that's what he'd drive.
Yeah, and everyone else is driving, we have Range Rovers, Lexis, Jaguars, Beamers. Have I left anything out?
I don't think so. I think that I sit in an office in Birmingham, and I see all these high-end luxury cars driving, right below my window all day, and that's probably why I put them in.
But, what's interesting about that, as an indication of place, you can go to any town in America that's sort of like Birmingham and the streets look alike in terms of the steel that's rolling.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
So you're coming over to a full-time writer from a career doing what?
Advertising. I've been writing ads for 30 years.
And what's the difference between writing 100 words and 85,000?
Well, the difference is that I don't care about writing ads. I mean, I don't care about the product or service that I'm writing about. I care deeply about the characters and the story when I'm writing fiction.
Yeah.
I don't see that there's really any similarity between the two. If you can write ads, doesn't mean you can write fiction.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Narrative point of view in both of your books, but especially in your books, Elmore, and, but it's true in yours, Peter. You shift narrative point of view often many times in a chapter. And this is something that a lot of writers have trouble with because they have trouble getting it right so that the reader knows whose head they're in.
Well, if you go down four spaces.
Sometimes that isn't enough, though. Now, I noticed in a lot of your earlier books, you often even put the name of the person as the first word in the first paragraph in that change.
That sounds like a good idea.
And how do you decide, in a given scene, whose head to be in?
Well, usually I'm in the main character's head or a very important character's head, but to then switch to the point of view of a minor character even, or at least the antagonist, you want to know. I want to know what the antagonist is up to.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no mystery in my story. You're reading both sides at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that leaves me out of it. You should not be aware of me, except that there is an overall sound that can be identified as my writing.
Well, that's the other thing that goes with it. Each character is voiced. They have their own vocabulary, their own idiolect, their own way of speaking.
Yeah.
How hard is that to get down? Where do you go? I've read one of your interviews that you've spent time visiting prisons and things, but you come up with such distinct voices that you hold consistently through those scenes.
Well, I think it's probably based on the character's attitude that gives me a sound.
Ah.
What he's up to, what he's against, what he's thinking. I don't know if I go in as much as I used to go into what characters are thinking, but it's certainly there. I don't perhaps use he thought as much as I used to, but it's there who they are, and they can be honest with you, or they can be lying to you or lying to themselves. It's part of the character, and we find out finally what everybody's up to, and then we'll see who wins.
Now, do you make notes about characters, or is this something you just carry in your head?
For the most part, it's in my head. But I will make notes. I'll think of things at night. I don't make notes at night. But if it's good enough, I'll remember it. And if I don't remember it, then it wasn't worth remembering.
Mm-hmm.
No?
I think that you have contrast between your characters. I think that's important. That Kundo Ray, for example, sounds different than Jack Foley. They're completely different guys.
Exactly.
Dawn Navarro, you know, obviously has her own sound, too. And I think it makes it easier when the characters are also different. The reader picks that up pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you have developed your style, have you picked your style up from reading your father's work?
Well, I think definitely, yeah. I mean, my father is one of my influences. I also read Hemingway. I've read a lot of Cormac McCarthy.
Yes.
Particularly No Country for Old Men, and learned a lot just by reading his spare, lean prose.
It's interesting because how much we learn just through writing. You were quoting someone as saying you had to write a million words.
That was John D. MacDonald. I corresponded with MacDonald for a few years, because he gave me a very good blurb, a great blurb. I forgot what book it was. And before that, he didn't know anything about me. So then he and I started corresponding. And he might have said it then,
mm-hmm.
but I doubt it. I think it was in print where I read it.
The letters are in Florida. Elmore has a place in North Palm Beach and a desk in the living room. There's a stack of letters between John D., and they're really, really interesting.
I really like the quote, or I really like the concept of the quote, because as I've talked to a lot of writers, that's really how you learn, isn't it? It's those thousands and hundreds of thousands of words that slowly teach us the craft.
Yeah. But you don't need to have written a million words to be published, good enough to be published or bad enough to be published, because I think some people can write millions of words
that are particularly awful. Favorite books? Like, I have my favorite Elmore Leonard books. Peter, do you have your favorite Elmore Leonard books?
I do. I think Glitz, La Brava, Freaky Deaky.
Freaky Deaky,
those
yeah.
three. I don't know. But then when I think about it, I add a few more. Riding the Rat and Tishomingo Blues.
One of my favorites,
so
yeah.
Ones. I'm actually rereading La Brava, and I'm amazed how good it is. It's really something. I'm curious about Kundo Ray because I had just read Road Dogs. And there he is in his leopard skin jockstrap in La Brava, you know, doing his thing.
Elmore, what do you have favorites for all of these children out there?
The first one I think of is Freaky Deaky.
Freaky Deaky.
Yeah. I'm not sure why, because I really like all of my books. There are some that I could have rewritten parts of and made it better, that I let the character slip, or I was using the character in the wrong way. I was using the wrong character as the who becomes the main character. It's from someone else's point of view, and this person dies, is killed, and then someone else comes along. I wasn't very careful about things like that, but on the whole, I like the way the story developed. Whenever a critic says, this is the best book in a while, I think, well, what was wrong with the ones that were not the best book? Well, I found out, for example, that two previous books, Out of Sight and...
The Hot Kid?
The Hot Kid, yeah.
And Up in Honey's Room?
Right. Those two are historical novels. And yet I'm in them. And that they didn't gain as much popularity as the others. So that now this Road Dogs, I'm back into the stride of what's going on now, and that seems to be more popular.
I am talking to Elmore Leonard and Peter Leonard, and you're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. Your essay on adverbs, exclamation points, and especially hoop-de-doodle, 10 rules for writers. Mm-hmm. What's a hoop-de-doodle?
This is what Steinbeck called show-off writing. When he's writing just as a writer to show you how good a writer he is, that doesn't necessarily have much to do with the plot of the novel. So that in Sweet Thursday, he has two or three chapters that are hoop-de-doodle one and two and so on. And he says you can skip those if you want. See? But in the prologue, and I don't, he does violate my rule, they're saying, I don't want to know what the author telling me what people look like. I want to figure it out for myself, the way they talk, the way they act, and so on. Which I thought was great, because this was written in about 56,
mm-hmm.
when I was starting out. I thought, good, I don't have to describe people anymore, because it was a chore to get it just right. And I would just as soon skip it and say something about it. He's a hairy guy, so, you know, and that would be enough.
What's your next book going to be, Peter? Have you started?
I have finished a third novel. It's
called Good for You.
As the Romans Do. And it opens with two American students in a holding cell in an Italian jail in downtown Rome. And the two guys had stolen a taxi and were caught by the Carabinieri, the national police, and they're on their way to Rabibbia prison for a short time. And that's how it opens. They encounter a low-level mafia street gang in prison, and that's kind of where the story takes off. This is actually based in part on a true story.
I was going to say, did you once get...
I was arrested for stealing a taxi cab in Rome when I was 20 years old and ended up spending 6 days and seven nights in Rabibbia prison, a maximum security prison outside Rome.
Did you get to call Dad?
No, I didn't get to call anyone.
Ah.
The head of the school did.
In Italy, you're guilty until proven innocent.
Yes.
And you know, I really knew nothing for the whole week and then went to trial, and I was found not guilty because I was in the back of the cab, and my buddy Steve Pappas, who was driving the taxi, was given a 17,000 lira fine, which was about, I don't know, 20 bucks.
Wow.
So all that for $20.
Major offense. And Elmore, your next book?
Djibouti. About the pirates, about a documentary filmmaker who's shooting the pirates in the Indian Ocean around the coast of East Africa and is sympathetic toward them for about the first 100 pages.
Well, I want to thank both of you. This has been very special, and thank you for your time.
Darren, thank you.
It's a wonderful interview. Thank you.
Enjoyed it. Thanks.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. I'd like to welcome Mary Elizabeth Pope back to Michigan Writers on the Air.
Thank you.
So last time you were here, near the end of the interview, I said, and what's next for Mary Beth Pope? And you said...
A collection of short stories.
And 4 years later...
Here it is.
Here it is. So could you tell our listeners about this collection of stories? It's
sure.
called Divining Venus.
Sure. The collection of stories is a thematically linked collection with characters who, in each story, discern something true about love.
And the protagonist in all the stories?
Is female.
A female, so it's always...
Broadly ranging ages.
Yes, from someone who is at their 25th high school graduation to...
Yeah. And there's an 11-year-old narrator, there is a 16-year-old narrator, 15-year-old narrator, and then there is an elderly couple in one of the later stories. So a pretty...
Wide range.
Pretty wide range.
Could you give our listeners a feeling for what these stories sound like by reading one of them?
Sure, absolutely. I will read from the second story in the collection, which is called The Marionette Theater. They had arrived in Prague in the middle of a rainstorm, the water pooling in gutters that ran down the center of the streets and prevented puddles as they rolled their wheeled suitcases over the cobblestones of Sokolovska to the apartment where Jonathan stayed on business trips and to which he returned each afternoon from his meetings to whisk Josie off on a tour of the castle, or a walk over the Charles Bridge, or a lecture on the history of the Jewish cemetery. It was not their honeymoon, a cruise to Barbados that would leave port the day after the wedding, but Josie's friends kept calling it one anyway. The first honeymoon, they said, and when Jonathan overheard them, he flashed the women a smile. We're so happy, he told them. We need two. And now they were here, and the city was every bit as beautiful as Jonathan had promised it would be, if not more so, in the slanting August light. But as they strolled along the cobblestones of the Golden Lane, stood in the tiny house where Kafka had written The Metamorphosis, took an evening cruise down the Voltava, sipping champagne from slender crystal flutes, Josie could not shake the feeling that none of it was real. The castle looked like one she had seen at Disney World, the Charles Bridge as if it were built of styrofoam bricks, the exterior of St. Vitus like a facade supported by scaffolding, so that when they had walked inside, the organ pipes and pulpits had surprised her. It was a feeling that had dogged her long before their arrival in Prague. Ever since Jonathan had pulled the diamond ring from his pocket and slipped it on her finger in the horse-drawn carriage he'd hired to take them around the park at Christmas time, nothing had seemed real. The ring itself was so bright and golden it could have dropped from a gumball machine, and when Jonathan said, "Will you marry me?" his words did not seem to come from deep inside him as Josie felt a question like that should. And then there were the wedding preparations, cakes that looked like sculptures, flowers so perfect she had to touch them to know they weren't silk, wedding gowns so white they looked almost blue. And the showers. Josie sat amidst grinning women who stroked her arms as if in welcome to the world of mixmasters and food processors and something called the cleanup factor. But as she unwrapped each new blender or microwave or toaster oven, they felt as flimsy as the cardboard kitchen set she'd had as a child, which had disintegrated into pulpy lumps when the basement had flooded. Tonight, they had tickets for the National Marionette Theater, the event Jonathan had saved for their last night in Prague, and as they ordered plates of goulash under the awning of a cafe in Old Town before heading to the theater, Josie thought back to their first date when he'd described it all to her. The performance of Mozart's Don Giovanni, the black cloaked puppeteers that made the darkness behind the set seem more alive than the puppets themselves, the way the tradition stretched back for centuries. And the puppets, he'd said, reaching for her hand across the table of the trendy bar where he'd taken her that first night. You will love the puppets. But in truth, it had never been his description of their painted faces or their elaborate costumes or the crowds that packed the theater to see them each night that convinced her that she would. It was the way he had said will, as if this was already their future together, because she was 31 years old and tired of the men her parents kept inviting over on the Sundays she joined them for dinner at their house in Gladstone. A Chiefs fan, her father would say, by way of explaining why a young man from the gun club or the son of one of the Elks was joining them. And to prove this wasn't a setup, Josie's father would hand him a beer and lead him downstairs to watch the game. And now she was in Prague with Jonathan, just as he'd promised she would be on that very first date. But even Jonathan did not seem real to her, hadn't seemed real since the moment he'd reclined in the carriage after proposing and began rehearsing all the things he'd soon be saying. I'd like you to meet my wife, he tried, or my wife always says. Then, I was just telling my wife. It was supposed to be a joke, but Josie had the feeling he wasn't telling it to her, and she'd felt a sudden hollowness in her stomach then that hadn't gone away. But ever since they'd called their parents from a payphone at the west end of the park, she hadn't had time to think about that hollowness, because there were invitations to order, and venues to reserve, and the registry to fill out, and then the engagement party Aunt Mildred had planned, and that family reunion of Jonathan's they'd promised to attend in Vermont. And now the wedding was only 3 weeks away, and Josie knew she did not want to marry him. For a week, she had been trying to tell him. They would arrive at the apartment after a concert in St. George's, or find themselves alone in the palace gardens, or pause to inspect a set of vases in the window of a shop in Wenceslas Square, and there would be a lull in all their forward motion, an opening, and she'd turn to him to say, look, or listen, or we need to talk. But whenever she tried to speak, her mouth would not form the words. And now the week was over, and they were leaving Prague in the morning, and as soon as the plane touched down in Kansas City, there would be the response cards to count, and the seating charts to arrange, and the second alteration with the shop girls who wanted her gown to be more fitted, though she could not breathe in the thing as it was. And before she knew it, they'd be on that cruise to Barbados, the wedding already behind them. Now she faced Jonathan across the table, watching him lift spoonfuls of soup to his mouth. She stared at him so long that he paused, his spoon in midair. Is something wrong? He asked. She did not know what would happen afterward. She could not picture his expression, nor the shock of their parents and neighbors and friends, nor the magnitude of the plans that would have to be undone. She only knew she had to tell him the truth. But she heard herself answer as if from a distance. Nothing, darling. Are you sure? He asked. You look pale. I'm fine, she said. They were words that did not come from inside her. They came from somewhere else instead, and they satisfied Jonathan, who turned back to his soup, nodded at a passing waiter, smiled when the horloge in the square behind them began ringing out 7 o'clock. But with each clang, Josie felt herself growing numb, and by the time the waitress delivered their goulash, she realized she could not feel her limbs. Then Jonathan paid the bill, and Josie felt herself being steered through the narrow streets to a tiny theater at the top of a cramped staircase that smelled of the Voltava. There was a moment before they entered when she might have spoken, and another when Jonathan paused to adjust his tie, and another after they were ushered down the aisle just before the show began. But by then it was too late. The doors had closed, and the curtain had lifted, and the puppets were already clattering away, whirling through the dance they'd been performing for centuries.
Mary Beth Pope reading from Divining Venus. I really admire that story.
Thank you.
And the rest of the stories in the volume. It's so easy to slide into these stories, to be part of them. I can remember being at a number of weddings where you look at the bride and groom and you, sometimes it's pure joy, but other times there's a panic and you don't know if it's the panic over getting married or if it's something deeper than that. One or the other or both want to run from the...
Well, weddings are such a strange phenomenon in our culture, you know, having been married, and I am married, I remember going into the shops to buy a dress or talking to caterers or, you know, sort of going through the process of planning a wedding and my husband and I trying to figure out, you know, like what do we want for our service? And at one point we talked about the fact that it was like putting on a play, you know, like you, there are these lines that you rehearse and everyone says essentially the same lines and it follows the same pattern. And within that, you know, there's sort of a profound lack of cultural agency. You know, you're doing what everyone is doing.
Exactly.
But it's, you know, you have to really think about it to be sure, I think, that you that is a choice that you are making. And and that worked very well as a story to tell using the Marionette Theater in Prague, which I have been to. And one of the things that I was really struck by and that I refer to in the story is the puppeteers. Because the puppets, the marionettes are amazing. They are so incredible. And you can really be lulled into the impression that they are the ones doing all of the moving. And every once in a while, you see a hand, you know, or a sort of cloaked face behind, the, you know, in the dark behind, and you realize it sort of pulls you out of the magic of the show, and you realize that there's someone back there pulling the strings, and or many people back there pulling the strings. And so I was so struck by that image, and then, you know, just the oddness of walking into a bridal shop and having the women behind the counter in every shop say the exact same thing to me. And so it all sort of came together, not easily. This was a very difficult story for me to write. It was very, very long when I first wrote it. And it took me about a year to get it drafted. It was probably four or five times as long as it ended up being. And I finally gave up because I felt just like it wasn't doing what I needed it to do. And then a couple of years later, I came back to it, and almost immediately, with that much distance, I could see that I needed to just edit out most of the story, and that a lot of the details that I had already used in different places really represented. I had developed the family, I had developed, you know, the relationship more. I had given a lot more time to the time that was spent in Prague, and I didn't need any of it. And so it was really a process of a story that initially failed, and then I gave it some time and came back to it and could see it really clearly then.
So where did the other stories come from? And what's your process for finding a topic, building a story?
I don't really always know. I don't know if you've read Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird, but she talks about how writers are afraid to talk about their process because they don't actually understand how it works themselves. And that's true for me. But often it will be something will be happening, and I won't be trying to write is normally how stories come to me. I will be washing dishes or, you know, like in the middle of driving or doing something. Or once I woke up in the car, and there's a story in my collection called Say Goodbye to Hollywood, and I woke up in the car and there was a Billy Joel song on the radio, and it was dark and my husband was driving, and it triggered a memory of a road trip that I had taken years before. And I happened to have just finished teaching the journey essay in my nonfiction class. And I was thinking, you know, a road trip and the music and it just kind of clicked. And I had this idea for this story, Say Goodbye to Hollywood. And so that's where it came from. I sort of woke up out of sleep, being asleep in the car, and it was dark and the music was on. And I just had this flash of a memory. And what I tell in the story is not what happened, but what I did with it was sort of take that memory and merge it with another experience I had with a friend of my parents who came to visit and stay with us, and he think he was about 65 at the time, and he was from Scotland. And I spent the whole week with him, taking walks and talking to him. And it kind of helped me realize that I was growing up mm-hmm. and growing out of some things that were going on in my life at the time. But it all kind of came together from various parts of my life. And so I guess what I would say about the stories is that they are more true in spirit than they are in fact, in any fact. The epiphanies that the characters reach are things that I've come to in my own life, but not necessarily in the way that they come together in the stories.
But that's true of fiction often, that the truth is there, even though...
Yeah.
Yes.
I think there's a fiction textbook called A Lie That Tells the Truth.
Yes.
Yeah.
You were working in creative nonfiction...
I was.
...when we talked 4 years ago. Well, you were starting to move towards fiction.
I was.
Would you talk about, you know...
Sure.
People get concerned about moving from genre to genre.
Yeah.
How did that happen for you?
How it happened for me was actually... there's a story in the collection called Rebound. And... I really wanted to work in second person, and I had an advisor on my dissertation committee when I was at Iowa who was very traditional and said, you can't use second person in nonfiction because then that would not be true. Mm-hmm. It would be, you would be sort of imposing on the reader an identity, and that you can't do that in nonfiction. So I decided to try my hand at...
So I immediately...
Yeah, well, so I mean, I couldn't do that for my dissertation, but what I decided to do was... once I had left graduate school and got a job teaching creative writing in Baltimore at the time, I started working on a story that I wanted to write in second person. And I realized the minute that I sat down to write it that although I had always worked in nonfiction before, because I think this is wrong. There are lots of writers who use second person in memoir now and in nonfiction. Yeah. But I was operating under the assumption that this is what I'd been told. And so I suddenly realized I get to make things up. I can do, you know, because I think for a lot of nonfiction writers, you reach a point in your writing where you think, oh, wouldn't it be great? I teach students all the time, and the students will say things like, wouldn't it be great if I could do this? And I say, but you can't do that because you're writing an essay. You have to, you know, you have to stick to the truth. And so I felt freed from having to stick with what actually happened. And so I wrote, that was the first story that I wrote for the collection was, actually I have two second person stories. The first story I wrote was Junior Life Saving. And
which is a wonderful story.
Oh, thank you. And that was actually the second person story that I started, that was the first story that I wrote for the collection. And then I had enjoyed it so much that I did it again with Rebound, which is the other second person story, because I was really enjoying second person. And then I wrote the story Divining Venus. That was the third story that I wrote for the collection. And I really love child narrators. I've always loved child narrators. I think their perspective is wonderful. And I really wanted to try to write a story with a child narrator. And it was while I was trying to come up with the title for this story that I wrote, and my husband and I were sort of talking about, I came up with the title for the story, Divining Venus. And
you should say a few things about that story, because there are elements there that go back to my childhood.
Yeah, it's got a lot of pop culture references in it. It was very hard to write, I will say.
But the Ouija board.
The Ouija board,
yes. I don't know if they have disappeared or not.
No, they're still around. Okay. They are still around. And so the divining in the title comes from the Ouija board that the girls in the story are using. And the name of the friend is Venus. And when I came up with the title for that story, I think my husband said, that would be a great title for the collection. Mm-hmm. And because I had written the other two stories, and at that point I had kind of a backlog of stories that I wanted to write, and I realized, wow, that actually does work, I think, for connecting all of these stories. They're all trying to divine something, through these experiences that the characters are having. And so that's how the book came together.
First sentences, or first paragraphs. I went through the book, and then it just struck me as I looked at one of those first paragraphs, well, I could use that as a prompt. And then I thought, well, I wonder how many other first paragraphs in this volume I could use as a prompt. So I went back through them. They're all terrific. I could write a story from those, and I could use them if I were teaching a short fiction class. I could pass those out. I would have a semester's work with your with your first paragraphs.
Thank you.
How does that happen?
Sometimes it is just dumb luck, and sometimes it is an incredible amount of work. Most of the stories in this collection have been published in literary magazines. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you learn as you're publishing in literary magazines is that if you cannot pull the reader in the first paragraph or probably the first page, it's unlikely that the editors at these magazines will keep reading because they have thousands of submissions. It's not to suggest that any of them are shirking their jobs. It's just that they can't, the sheer volume of what they're dealing with is they're not going to keep reading if they're not pulled in. And so knowing that and realizing that I absolutely had to grab the reader's attention right off the bat, right out of the gate, was one of the reasons why I worked really hard to make sure that they were engaging.
I hope to see you in a year or two.
I hope so too. thank you very much.
Mary Beth Pope, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Again, the collection of short stories is titled Divining Venus, and the website is maryelizabethpope.com. Fleeta Brown is here. She's back from the cottage. Fall is beginning. And who are you going to tell us about this month?
I would like to introduce you to a poet, Aaron. I was just introduced to a short time ago myself. I'm glad and excited to be aware of his work. His name is Maurice Manning. He grew up listening to stories of his father's childhood on a farm in eastern Kentucky, and he's been inspired by the lives of his grandmothers, great-grandmothers, and a great-great-grandmother. The book I want to talk about is called The Common Man. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2010. Some poets try to mimic a dialect, like Robert Burns did it. He did it really well for the Scots dialect. But a lot of times the attempt comes off strained and, kind of belittling of the original. I think Maurice Manning's poems managed to convey deep respect while giving us the flavor of the country voices with no irony. There may be irony in the story told, but we, the readers, aren't allowed to feel superior. I'll give you an example. This is a pretty long poem in short couplets, like every other poem in this collection. I'm guessing he finds this form a natural outgrowth of the blunt, no-nonsense speech of the speakers. This one's called A Ringer Washer on the Porch. A few of us do remember ringer washers. A Ringer Washer on the Porch. Now it's not the eyesore you might think. There's plenty of reasons why a porch is just the place for a ringer washer. I know a possum who lived in the tub of one winter, and a boy I know, well, let's just say he hung his coat in a funny place that year. Some folks don't have too many clothes, which simplifies their lives. A man might have two pair of breeches to his name, a woman one black dress for funerals, and something less fancy for all the other days. And this is the real humdinger of the romantical tale I'm fixing to tell, an apron. You know the kind I mean, the kind with strings the woman ties without a peak behind her back. There was a man around those parts who lived alone and, according to a number of his neighbors, was not well practiced in domestic arts, which is to say this fellow kept a ringer washer on his porch, and as far as anyone could tell, seldom was the washer put to its intended purpose, and in fact was just the size to accommodate the recipe this uncouth man had concocted to make a batch of wine. It was summer, blackberry time. Enter now a woman, a bit high-strung, some say, who'd lately joined the local temperance league and thus had been appointed to apprise this man of all his wickedness. What followed next remains unclear, but it's apparent that the man did not take kindly to the wrath of a woman he didn't even know and her judgments about what he kept on his porch. Some sort of scuffle soon broke out, and in the confusion, the strings that held that woman's apron around her waist got wound up in the wringer somehow. She was stuck like a fly to a tape. And the man, a little pleased, I guess, sat down on an old nail keg. He might have scratched himself, for all I know, in a place that, shall we say, would have offended a lady's sensibilities. The story goes she began to holler, and the more she hollered, the madder she got, until pretty soon she was cussing him. About the time the moon came up, the woman grew hoarse and hushed. The man took a look at the moonlight on her hair and smiled. "You know what I reckon," he said. "You're twice as intemperate as me, sister." Well, you can probably figure out what happened next. They laughed, and then he convinced her that a little wine might soothe her throat, and he was right. It did, so she had a little more, and before she knew it, she was soothed all over and was kind of glad she'd got wound up in that wringer after all. And by gum, it was one hell of a porch that was a dancing on. I forgot to tell you, after a while the man and woman started dancing. He took the handle of the wringer and wound her out to him and wound her back. The crickets must have chirped the tune. Remember the boy who hung his coat in the washer tub? Well, he was born, all right, about a year later. The possum didn't live there yet.
Wow.
Manning's a great storyteller. You might also notice, if I read it well enough, that the lines are each four beats long. So you get that ballad feel to the poem. Ta-dum, 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 ta-dum. Remember the boy who hung his coat in the washer tub while he was born. That's one couplet with me exaggerating the beat so you can hear it better. This collection is full of tales like this one. Here are some poem titles to give you a sense. Sowing butter beans with a stick, emptying a rain gauge, a lexicon for people who don't talk too much, the doctrine of an axe, the beats theology, and so on. You'll notice that the one who speaks the poem is sophisticated. You get words like theology that might not be used by the character in the poem. So there's the double vision of the town guy with the education, who's in a way translating the tale as best he can recall he heard it. Again, I want to say, that's hard to pull off without some sense of condescension, which I don't sense here at all. Here's a slightly different poem where you hear the voice of the educated narrator more clearly. In a way, it's an apology, in the old sense of the word, an argument for the book. It's called Oh, Stationers. A stationer, I might mention, since in a way it's almost obsolete, is one who sells writing supplies. And later in the poem when he says, would any one of your company, company's capitalized, so he means any one of you stationers. You people don't know the half of it. How many words are gone forever, no syllable or sound remains. How many stories die on the lips of the teller. What diversity of meters never mattered, what old numbers never made your list, and what will not be entered on this date or any other ever. The story of two boys who stole a horse and rode it all the way to Glory Land, and one of them was barefoot and cried a little bit. What could the other boy have said to make the barefoot boy all right, if anything? There must have been a fable way back when about a spider and a wren. The bird has a broken leg, but the spider spins a tiny splint because the wren has promised to teach the spider how to sing, which actually happens, though the wren retains a permanent limp. The two of them become old friends, and yes, sometimes they weave and spin from being drunk on happiness. Would any one of your companies subscribe to that? Would anyone agree to print a vulgar verse, my father said to me? I had a little chick that wouldn't lay an egg, so I poured hot water up and down her leg. The little chick cried and the little chick begged, and then the little chick laid me a hard-boiled egg. Is that not terrible and beautiful at once? I tell you, when I heard it as a boy, it made me want to get a chicken. It made me feel my father had thrown a book against my head. That's not a simple story. It gets to the impossibility of saving the language from change and losing parts of it, including the stories of that sadness of that. But it's so silly and funny, you see how the language has been saved after all. I'll read one more poem, The Song of the Potato Digger. You get such a sense of the right relation between humans and the soil, between humans and their food. Potatoes like me, they do. They know I'm quiet in their rows, which lets them better hear the silver song of my gooseneck hoe, although I am undoing some of them each time the hoe comes down to sound its note. I bank the open wound with dirt, and if a dram of sweat rolls off my chin, the potatoes think I'm weeping at my task, and in a way I am. This work is often bitter, I tell you. But can you think of anything that's good that doesn't come from salt? Can you imagine a man whose views are more boiled down than mine, a man who isn't cursed so much as bound to think about his work? I can't. But that's all right. I'm limited. I break the heart of every day. I tuck a stone in my pocket and walk outside to hang the hoe across my shoulder like a lamb. And then I heal the day as best I can by bending gladly over it. I make a long apology, a necessary song, before I straighten up and sweep my face goodbye. Forget me for the night, I say, to anyone who's left to listen. My hilly world is sweet. Love is grim. Sometimes I stoop to eat it as I would a breath. And yes, we see that love is grim. We have to destroy to eat and eat to live every day. Yet there's something in here of the deep and sweet relationship of each thing to each thing. Maurice Manning is on the faculty of the MFA program at Warren Wilson College and the Swanee Writing Conference. He's a professor of English at Transylvania University, which is a liberal arts school in Lexington, Kentucky. The name of the book is The Common Man.
Thank you, Felita. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Mary Elizabeth Pope and Felita Brown. Also, kudos to Brock Mormon and Brad Aspey for their skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next month to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.